It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This year, Wisconsin has its largest presence ever of musicians at Austin's South by Southwest Music Festival. And throughout the show today, we're going to be playing songs by those bands. What you just heard is Blame Me by Hugh Bob and The Hustle. Lead singer Hugh Masterson grew up in Butternut, Wisconsin, up north, a little town with a population of about 300. Hugh Bob and The Hustle play what's known as North Country Rock and Roll. Let's listen. And we've got more Wisconsin music coming your way in the program. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday, and the date is 314, which only means one thing. We're going to be talking about pie. A pie enthusiast from WPR will be joining us to share recipes and talk about his favorite pies of all time.
First, though, we're tracking Wisconsin's musical talent and heading down to Austin, Texas for South by Southwest to check in on how Wisconsin bands have been performing this year. With our largest presence ever at the festival, Wisconsin will be putting on performances of all sizes. Better known bands like Fox and Hugh Bob and The Hustle are playing official shows. And in addition, over 30 Wisconsin acts were featured at the Milwaukee Home Stage this past Wednesday.
Joining us now from Austin to update us on those performances is Milwaukee Journal Sentinel music writer Piet Levy.
Piet, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So we're playing songs from Wisconsin bands at South by Southwest throughout the show today. We started with Blame Me by Hugh Bob and The Hustle. What do we know about these guys?
Yeah, well, they're based in Milwaukee. The main guy, Hugh Robert Masterson, he's from Butternut, which is a really tiny community. He lives in Milwaukee now, and they're, you know, kind of a bar room country rock band. They have started to get some attention from CMT. CMT is going to be premiering their music video, I think, in a couple of weeks. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, I'm the music writer from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We had a feature, 10 Wisconsin Bands to Watch, and Hugh Bob and The Hustle is definitely a very promising band that should get some bigger attention, I predict, beyond the Milwaukee area, just because they have a really good sound. They're really dedicated performers. They are getting some attraction from people in Nashville. They had a song that had a placement on Nashville. So they're very good. And if you're at South by Southwest, hustling, you know, no pun intended, I guess, playing shows, networking with people. And, yeah, that's what bands come out here to do, that and party.
Of course, we can't forget the party part. Well, their sound is something, it's called North Country. What does that mean? Is that something, loneliness, empty bars, desolate highways? Is that the North Country sound?
I think maybe so. I mean, I think they kind of describe themselves as like Midwest country a little bit too. And that's kind of their description for it. I mean, it's definitely, it's not like necessarily straight up twangy country. It's definitely not country pop. It feels like it's almost like indie rock gone country in a lot of ways. And I think that's also helped them too, because country is just a growing, booming market. We're starting to hear more diversity in country. Last year there was a lot of complaints about the bro country movement and how radio was very, didn't have a lot of openness, open-mindedness. But then last year we also saw artists like Casey Musgraves, Brandi Clark come in with a kind of an alternative sound. And I think as country continues to grow and as country's audience continues to get younger, I think that puts Hugh Bob and The Hustle in a really great position.
Well, you've been down at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas for a few days now. Can you set the scene for us? Describe it. What is it like?
It is insane. I think that's a mild way to put it. It's my second year here, and it's nothing. Basically, it's a massive festival that's been going on for a few decades now. It's really grown to a beast. The whole kind of myth behind South by Southwest, or the brand idea, is that you come here to discover new music, and that's still definitely possible. But, as it's attracted tons of artists hoping to get discovered or to make great connections, it's also attracted massive artists and brands. Lady Gaga played the Doritos Bowl stage on Thursday night. Had Kanye West and Jay-Z do a show for Samsung for attendance. Coldplay did a show for iTunes. So it's a really huge thing. But at the same time, you also have thousands of bands playing official Southwest showcases, little-known bands, and also a lot of bands playing maybe just as much, playing unofficial shows, just here to just see if they can bump into somebody, here to just play music, here to kind of feel what the vibe is like. It's really crazy. People are having a lot of fun. I think people can get pretty stressed. I've seen a few agitated bands, around town. But it's an interesting, nutty, crazy experience. And we had a lot of Wisconsin bands this year, way more than we've had in recent years.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. South by Southwest is an event that can make stars. It's a big opportunity. Are there any Wisconsin bands that you think have the opportunity to really break out this year?
Well, I'll say that South by Southwest, I think there is that idea that it can make stars, but I would still hesitate on that a little bit because I think a lot of the bands that kind of break out of South by Southwest are kind of known going in, or there's a buzz kind of going into it. At this point, it's so crowded, it's so huge, there's so many things happening. I think the idea of a band comes here, they get seen by some, record exec drinking a Shiner Bock, and they're like, oh, I'm going to sign those guys right now. That's kind of a myth. But the great things can still happen. I mean, last year there's a band called Fox. They're in Madison. Terrific band, and that might be one of the most promising indie rock bands out of Wisconsin right now. They just got signed to Partisan Records. They played South by last year. It's their first show, I think, out of Wisconsin. And they kind of came, there was some buzz around them already. They had a video EP that was really ambitious that was gaining some traction. They came, played some shows, had low expectations. They did happen to play in front of a manager who offered her services. And she's a well-connected manager. She manages the Lumineers. And she got Fox to play at Lollapalooza in Chicago last year. She helped Fox open for the Lumineers at the iTunes Festival in London. She got them on tour, or she helped get them connected to get on tour with Blitz and Trapper. They're now signed to Partisan. So things like that can happen. So as far as this year goes, so with Wisconsin bands breaking out, I mean, we'll just have to see. I don't expect any Wisconsin bands are going to suddenly become superstars or get record deals necessarily right away. But hopefully they do meet some people that can kind of help them in some small way. And as far as bands that might stand a better chance of doing that, Vic and Gab is a band from Milwaukee. It's like a pop rock band that they were doing some official showcases and have gotten some national media attention. U-Bob and Hustle doing official showcases as well. And then on a small level, a really small level, there's a band called Paper Holland from Milwaukee. It's a band I really like. They're kind of a pop rock band. They have a little bit of a Death Cab for Cutie vibe to them sometimes, with a little more upbeat energy. And, their song was just kind of discovered randomly by Stephen Thompson at NPR, and he included it in a 100-song ecstasy playlist. So, again, I don't think Paper Holland's necessarily going to get a million calls from people, but they were just so ecstatic to get some national attention like that. So you just have to kind of come in with measured expectation.
I understand the Milwaukee home stage was on Wednesday. What was that like? How did it go?
Yeah, what was interesting, and the reason I think there are so many Wisconsin acts here this year, is because a few folks got together and kind of had this idea to do a Milwaukee showcase. The folks that organized it include one of the owners of Hotel Foster. It's a venue, small venue in Milwaukee, and also Melissa Thornton. She founded an apparel company called Milwaukee Home in Milwaukee. And they kind of came up with this idea, and they thought they would do it for 2015. There's a lot of that around South by Southwest. You'll see showcases for Portland bands or Colorado bands or bands from England. And they wanted to do something for Milwaukee. But they had this idea around Christmas. In January, they founded a club that was like right smack between the Austin Convention Center and 6th Street was available. And they decided to go ahead and jump at the opportunity. So they tried to put together a showcase for Milwaukee bands in like 2 months' time. And they wanted to go really ambitious, so they got 30 bands to sign up for it. And they went to raise money, and they raised about $24,000. It was pretty crazy. I mean, I think for anyone who has experience, that would be a really, really hard thing to kind of pull off. So it happened. It definitely had hiccups. There are definitely things to learn. Ultimately, I think the showcase they basically played for themselves and played for friends more so than attracting people from booking agents and things like that. But it was a start, and I think a lot of bands, even though there were some hiccups and frustrations, I think a lot of bands were excited to have the opportunity, excited to be here, excited to see other bands. Some of these bands have been meeting up with other bands randomly. So, there's still benefits, too.
So looking back, we've had Justin Vernon come out of Wisconsin. You've got Fox up and coming out of Wisconsin. Does Wisconsin have a reputation for being an up-and-coming state that's a good place for music?
I think it's definitely recognized. I think having Justin Vernon, for sure, helps. And, Vernon has this band, Volcano Choir, that he's in with current and former members of an avant-garde group in Milwaukee called Collection of Colonies of Bees. They're a group that has some cult recognition, but when they teamed up with Vernon, just because of Vernon's name, suddenly these guys were able to play bigger venues than they've ever played before and tour places they've never been before and have, snacks on a touring bus. So I think by having someone that has, a name like that, it definitely helps. It kind of creates a wave effect.
All right, Piet, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for giving us the sights and sounds of South by Southwest.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate the opportunity.
We've been speaking with Piet Levy, music writer at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He is in Austin, Texas, covering Wisconsin bands at the South by Southwest Festival.
Wisconsin has its biggest presence ever at the festival this year, and throughout the show today, we are playing songs by Wisconsin bands performing down there in Austin.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. It's time for Food Friday. And since today's date is 3-1-4, what better time to talk about pie?
And the first person who came to our minds when we thought pie was, of course, Michael Leland. He's the news director here at Wisconsin Public Radio and a pie lover to the max. He's with us to talk pie. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks to be here.
Well, we're starting with a big question here. What do you love about pie?
What don't I love about pie? And I think you had me on the show because you figured, well, he'll bring a pie in if he's going to be on the show. I have just, it was always a treat, when I was growing up. It's not something, mom made brownies a lot. She made cookies. But holidays were when the pie came out, whether it was from mom or from my grandmother. So it was always something kind of special. And as I got older, I always liked to cook, but once I got out on my own, I thought, well, how hard can it be to make a pie? Give me a try. And the rest is sort of history.
So how hard is it to make a pie? As I understand it, I haven't heard the story yet, but I understand your first attempt at making a pie did not go so well.
There's nothing wrong with walking away from something for, I don't know, say 10 years if it doesn't go well the first time. I had a little bit of trouble with the crust. I wanted to make my own crust because I thought if I'm going to make a pie, I'm going to make a pie. Mm-hmm. And the crust was sticking to the rolling pin and not going well, and I was probably saying things that we can't say on the radio. And I decided this is just too much stress, and I just put it away and just never thought about it until about 10 years later. I thought, I haven't tried making a pie in a long time. Let me just follow the instructions, mm-hmm. and how hard can it be? And
it was better this time, I think?
For some reason. To this day, I don't know why, but it just went better. And since then, I probably make several a year now, and that was... we're looking at the last 15 years now. So it's not real difficult. It's more time consuming than anything. And you kind of have to be patient because sometimes it doesn't go quite the way you want it to the first time if you've never made one before. But it's not awful.
Do you remember what the pie was that brought you back from the pie abyss?
It was probably just a basic apple pie. I tend to make a lot of fruit pies. I make some savory pies, but for the most part, it's fruit or, there's one I make around this time of year that's got chocolate and marshmallow and Guinness stout in it. But for the most part, it's stuff you want to have for dessert.
Now, you just mentioned there, often just such an offhand manner. There's one I kind of make. That pie is legendary, Michael, at WPR.
It's the one, yes, it's the most requested.
It has Guinness?
It has a Guinness stout in it. I'm sure other stouts work, but I usually use Guinness. It's got mini marshmallows and chocolate chips, melted chocolate chips. Those are the three big ingredients. It's also got a few other small things here and there. It's easy to make. You can make it pretty much in your blender and then dump it into a graham cracker crust that you can either make yourself in about 10 minutes or you can buy one. And, the one I made for today, I think I threw it together in 20 minutes last night and then put it in the fridge because you don't have to cook it. And as you can attest, it's a big hit.
It's a huge hit. And
20 minutes well invested, and look at all the love it's brought just in one.
That's right. People
one
will
day.
Love you.
It'll
if you
get
make
you
fun.
On the radio, people.
You know, but you mentioned in your horror story from many, many years ago when you started making pies. And just there as an aside, you said you could use your own crust or you could make a crust or whatever. That's also always something people think about, because I think it actually stops a lot of people from making pies, is that fear of the crust.
Mm-hmm.
So where are you at these days? Homemade or do you buy? And what are the pros and cons?
I mean, because I'm usually able to make a crust without any, you know, a great disaster, I always at least try to make a crust. I only buy a crust if I know I just don't have a lot of time and just want to, you know, knock the pie out real quick. But for the most part, I would say 95% of the time I will just, you know, make a crust.
So what's the secret to a good crust?
Boy, you know, I don't even know if there is one. I mean, the one I use is just a real basic recipe. It's just flour, a little bit of salt, about a third of a cup of butter, a third of a cup of Crisco, some water, mix it up, and you know, let it sit in the fridge for a bit and then roll it out. And yeah, I mean, there are other variations. There are some crusts with a lot more butter and vodka in it, which always makes people go, oh, really, vodka? But you can't taste it because it cooks out.
So what's the point?
It's it makes it flakier. It makes it, I would say it's got a richer taste to it, and it can be flakier than the standard butter Crisco crust. Noah Ovshinsky is always after me to try lard in my pie crust. I haven't gotten there yet, lard, because I don't know where to buy lard. But but one of these days I'll try that. But I just go with what's easy.
Well, my grandmother was a big believer in lard, and it works. So if you can find it,
one of these days, it's on my list.
Give it a shot.
I'm sure there's lard to be had somewhere in Wisconsin.
You'd think.
Got a hunch.
You'd think.
Now, we mentioned your chocolate stout silk pie. Now, you use Guinness, and we do have that recipe up on our Facebook page. And because it has Guinness, I think it's fair to pass that off as a St. Patty's recipe.
Well, this is sort of how this is actually how I found this pie. We were having a St. Patrick's Day party here at WPR. This is only a pie I've been making about for 7 or 8 years. So I went online. I thought, you know, I'm going to make something St. Patrick's Day. And I found this website that had Irish, you know, related recipes. And this was a recipe that had been posted by a brew pub in New Brunswick, Canada. And I thought, well, it's pie, so I could make that. And it's got Guinness in it, so that makes it Irish. So here we are, and that's really where it came from. I don't even know if this place is still in business anymore, but you know, I'm forever in their debt for
their
posting that recipe.
Their pie lives on,
right.
Huh? You also make one, I gather, an apple maple cranberry pie. What do you like about that one?
Yeah, I like it because, I mean, it's all of the things that I really like a lot. You know, I love apples, I love cranberries, I love anything maple. I grew up in Massachusetts. Those are all great products from where I came from, and as it turns out, they're great products from here in Wisconsin as well. So it's a little bit of home and a little bit of where I live now when I make it. But I just love all of those tastes together, and it's a pie that I like a lot. And it's also fairly easy. It's actually more time consuming than the chocolate pie, because you've got to cook down the cranberries and that sort of, you know, you've got to peel about, you know, 3 pounds worth of apples. But it turns out well. I like it.
Speaking of taste or all together, let's talk about savory pies for a second. You've got a recipe for a pork and apple pie.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a recipe I found in a British cookbook. This is a day long project. It takes about 4 hours to make it. And you've got to make a thick crust that pretty much stands up on its own. You don't even make this in a pan or in a pie plate. You've got to make a crust that you tie string around the outside to support the walls of it.
I was going to make a joke about bracing, but it sounds like it's no joke.
You really do. You have to brace this thing. It's got ground pork and bacon and cubed cut up pork in it. So wow. Three different kinds of pork and apples, some sage and a few other things. I can't remember what, but you cook it for about 2.5 hours. It's fantastic, but it's a project.
It's a project, and what, I mean, what else would you have with that? I mean, it sounds like a meal in itself.
It's pretty much a meal in itself. I might steam some broccoli just to convince myself that maybe it's a bit of a health food.
I can't believe the three kinds of pork in that pie.
I call it the three pigger.
For more than one reason. Yeah. Right. That sounds like a big one. So what advice do you have for the pie novice, someone who's intimidated, maybe like you used to be, by the idea of making pies, but they want to try?
If you just want to make a pie, buy the crust and concentrate on the fillings, and then maybe someday try a crust or buy a crust and have it in reserve in case the crust you try to make doesn't turn out the way you like. At least you haven't lost the pie completely. But give it a try. I mean, it's not a difficult thing, and don't worry about how it looks. That's the other thing, that if my crust tears, I will just patch it with another piece of dough that I'm not using. And it's all about the taste. It's not about the presentation, at least in my world.
Well, Michael, thanks for being here today.
Happy to be here. Thanks a lot.
That was Michael Leland, news director and pie master here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
And don't forget, the recipe for that Guinness marshmallow pie with chocolate is up on the Central Time Facebook page in time for St. Patrick's Day.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're listening to When You Walk Into the Room by Milwaukee-based sisters Vic and Gab. To give props to Wisconsin's musical talent playing at the South by Southwest Festival in Austin this week, we're playing songs by Wisconsin bands who are performing there throughout the show.
The two sisters, Victoria and Hannah Gabriella, fell into the music scene when one of their songs was picked up by an MTV show. They recently released their first full-length album, Love of Mine, which they worked on in a cabin in Door County. Later in the show, we'll hear from the bands Fox and Fever Marlene. But right now, let's hear a little more from Vic and Gab. All right, so who doesn't love a good villain? In movies and television, of course, there are plenty of pretend villains to root against. But, if you dig into American history, you'll find plenty of real-life examples.
And many of these lesser-known villains boast unbelievable stories of their own, stories that screenwriters and producers could only wish they came up with on their own. And in a new book, our next guest has chronicled some of those stories and paints a picture of the shadier side of American history.
Joining us now is Paul Martin. He is a former writer and editor for the National Geographic Society. His new book is Villains, Scoundrels, and Rogues, Incredible True Tales of Mischief and Mayhem. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Gene. Veronica.
We had you on the air a couple of years ago on Wisconsin Public Radio for a book that you had written about unsung American heroes, but now you're back with a book on sort of the other side of America. Why swing to that other side?
Well, it's after I finished the book about heroes, I just thought it would be interesting to look into some of the more colorful villains. I've always been a history buff, and for years I'd collected stories that I'd run across in reading or on the History Channel and various places, and most of them were heroic in nature. They'd done something positive, and I really kind of started from scratch when I started looking into villains, and it was an eye-opening journey, because very quickly you can get bogged down in the horrific end when you start looking into crime. So many of the books that you find are about the horrific murders, the serial killers, and that gets old fast. So I wanted to find out about all sorts of offenders. So I made a list of every type of ne'er-do-well I could come up with, everything from counterfeiters and pirates to rustlers and gunslingers. And then I began looking for the most colorful example of each one of these that I could find. And I think the book is a lot of fun. To tell you the truth, it was more fun to research and write this than to working on the Heroes book, for a very specific reason. With these characters, I did not have to maintain a reverential attitude. With the heroes, I had to, you know, I had to be very serious all the time. With these characters, some of them are just playing off the wall, and it was, you know, I could poke a little fun at them, be irreverent from time to time.
In fact, you break the folks in this book into three basic groups, right there in the title: villains, scoundrels, and rogues. What are the differences? I mean, they're all sort of variations on the same theme, right?
Well, exactly. What I did when I had this collection, I had, you know, several dozen people, and I started analyzing how I could organize this into some comprehensible presentation. So I decided to come up with a hierarchy of three. And the villains, of course, are the very worst of the lot. They're the serial killers and they're really the heinous criminals. The scoundrels are a notch lower. They're still did some sort of a serious crime, but they're not of the shocking nature of that first group of the villains. And the third group, the rogues, these are the people who just, they may have only screwed up once in their life. They may have been normal people who just sort of went off the rails at some point, and sometimes it was because of a personality flaw. In other words, they were not hardened criminals. So I think by having these three layers, three levels, it just makes for a more interesting and easier to grasp presentation.
Yeah, in fact, some of the rogues, you know, you could find yourself sitting down and having a drink with them, and it would be a perfectly wonderful conversation. But some of the villains, these are people you don't want to have anything to do with, really.
Some of the villains, especially one from your neck of the woods, Ed Gein, he was so monstrous that I couldn't even write about some of the things he did. He was, of course, psychotic. He was crazy as could be, but his crimes were so horrific that you kind of talk around them. Whereas the more characters such as the rogues, I would love to sit down with. I have two characters, Maggie and Kate Fox, and they were young children in an isolated farmhouse in New York back in the 1840s, and they were sort of bored, and so they decided to play a trick on their mother, and they pretended to contact the spirit of a traveling salesman that had supposedly been killed in their house. And they did this by cracking their knuckles and toe joints, and their mother bought it entirely. She thought they were contacting the dead. The neighbors came in, and before long, this thing spread out of control. They ended up, these two young girls, one was, I believe, 11 and the other 14 at the time, they became the most well-known mediums in the country, and they started what has become known as the spiritualism movement, which is really a kind of a quasi-religion for people who believe that we can contact the dead. They eventually confessed that they'd made the whole thing up, and the interesting thing is that the believers in spiritualism didn't believe them. They didn't believe the confession. So they were sort of trapped into this persona that they'd created almost by accident, and it would be fun to sit down with them and chat about their experiences.
Another person that you outline in the book is a woman named Mildred Gillars, I think that's how you pronounce it. And you might not know that name, but a lot of people would recognize the name Axis Sally.
Exactly. I had heard of Axis Sally all my life, and I sort of vaguely knew that, like Tokyo Rose, during World War II, she was an American traitor. But I didn't really know her story. And she's actually rather tragic. She grew up in Ohio, and she went to college and studied to become an actress, but she just never achieved any success. She went to New York after college and got a few small acting parts on Broadway and into some traveling show theaters productions, but she was always just really scratching around the edges of the theatrical world. And she went to Europe to try to improve her fortunes in the 1930s and ended up getting a job with German radio. Well, when the World War II came along, the American government told all American citizens, you know, come home from Germany. And she stayed there. That was her fatal mistake. She stayed there. And because she was finally getting some artistic recognition through German radio, she preferred to remain where she was. Well, when the war began, the Germans realized they had a perfect person here to engage in propaganda. Here was an American. She had a very wonderful speaking voice. I've listened to tapes of her speaking. And she broadcast anti-Semitic rants and tried to talk the American soldiers and allies out of fighting Hitler. And she ended up, after the war, she was brought back to this country and tried for treason and sent to prison for 11 years.
Lots and lots of stories here. We're talking with Paul Martin. He is the author of Villains, Scoundrels, and Rogues. And those include some of the little-known but very bad villains that have existed throughout American history. We'll be picking that conversation up in just a moment.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're talking with Paul Martin about his new book, Villains, Scoundrels, and Rogues, about some of those lesser-known real-life villains in American history. Paul Martin, we have a comment here from Bill in Lancaster who asks, did you do anything on Doc Brinkley, a quack doctor from Kansas in the 30s? He's got to be at the top of the list of scoundrels, and you did, actually.
Well, I did John Brinkley.
Oh, a different Brinkley.
Yeah, John Brinkley was, and that may be who he's thinking of. Brinkley was famous. He was known as the goat gland doctor.
Mm-hmm.
He, from the 1920s into the late 30s, made millions of dollars a year by implanting goat testicles into male patients, supposedly to restore their virility. Of course it was useless, and 42 people died from the procedure. But he had a special train. He was in a clinic at in Milford, Kansas, which was 65 miles west of Topeka, out in the middle of nowhere. And he had a special train, came out to his clinic, 50 patients a week, every week of the year, just came out there to pay $750 for this useless procedure.
And that was such a great story because he used radio at then a very new medium to kind of spread the word, and he played a lot of games in the early history of radio.
He did. He's famous because one of the first things he did was he had a medical question box, it was called. It was a show on the air, and he would take encourage people to write him with their medical problems, and he would read the letters on the air. Then he would prescribe medicines to that they needed. And, of course, those medicines were only available in pharmacies that paid him kickbacks. So he was making millions of dollars through that scam. Finally, he was run out of Kansas. He was they took his medical license away, and he ended up in Del Rio, Texas. And I think his real fame in terms of radio is he had one of the first what they call border blasters.
Mm-hmm.
They were these humongous radio towers that could broadcast virtually all over the United States and was located in Mexico just across the international border. So the American authorities couldn't do anything about it. And he actually did a lot of pioneering. He had some of the early country western singers. He pioneered a lot of different programming techniques that became the staple of radio.
Yep, he was a legend, and he is a very familiar story to people who follow broadcasting, but it's good that you hear about the other side, too, the part where he was a scoundrel. Another person that you focused on towards the end of the book, and it was kind of a lovable story, actually, one of those rogues I think you were talking about, the frugal counterfeiter. I'm not sure if I can pronounce his name, Emmerich Jüttner, and there's a picture of him here, and he is this sort of ancient, very pleasant-looking old man holding a bunch of dollar bills.
He was one of my favorite characters. He was a record-setting counterfeiter. He went from 1938 to 1948 without being caught. That was over 9 years. That's the longest any counterfeiter has ever operated. He didn't start till he was 63. He had come to this country as an immigrant from Austria. And when he got old, he retired, and his wife passed away, and he was in his 60s, and he was having a hard time making ends meet, so he started counterfeiting, of all things, $1 bills. That's all he counterfeited, and that was one of the reasons he didn't get caught, because nobody would think to look at a $1 bill to see if it was counterfeited. He also never victimized the same business twice, because he didn't want anybody to take too much of a loss because of him. So he was really a crook with a conscience.
And there, you tell a story early on in there about he had this little dog that would go around with him, and he was very cute. And I don't want to say he was above suspicion, but who would expect this darling old guy with his dog?
He was just a lovable old man with no teeth who just smiled all the time, and he would take his fake $1 bills, which, by the way, were horrible fakes, because he misspelled George Washington's name.
And
he printed them on bond paper, I mean, of all things. But he would go into, like, a butcher shop and buy some scraps for his dog for 15 cents and give them a dollar bill. And then he'd get 85 cents in real change. And that, for him, was a big score, a pocketful of actual change.
Yeah, this is such a great book. There are so many good stories in here. And before we let you go, I mean, is there anybody that didn't make the book? Do we have another book of villains, scoundrels, and rogues in the making somewhere?
Oh, I have an unlimited number. I'm not sure if I want to write more about villains. I've written about heroes and I've written about villains, and there's so many other categories of interesting Americans, inventors, scientists, you name it. You could do a similar book on any topic.
All right, and the last question, who's your favorite villain in this whole thing? Who's your favorite scoundrel? Who's your favorite rogue?
Well, I don't know if I can call him my favorite, but I had a personal tie to two characters. One of them was James Lane, who was a senator from Kansas. There was a famous raid on Lawrence, Kansas, it was 1863 or 64, in which about 200 young men and boys and men were killed by Missouri raiders led by William Quantrell. Well, the reason for that raid was that James Lane, who was a senator and an abolitionist, had in 1861 gone over into Missouri and burned the town of Osceola. And he hanged 9 people that he thought were Confederates. Well, my personal connection is that my father happened to have been born in Osceola. I mean, many years after the Civil War. But I had that personal connection all my life. And when I started looking into this story, it was just a wonderful story. And it actually is part of, if you've ever seen the Outlaw Josie Wales, Eastwood movie, that's the basic story. There's a character in there. I don't know if they name him, but there's a character that plays James Lane.
Well, it's a great place, and I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, Paul. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me on, Gene.
We've been talking about some of the lesser-known real-life villains throughout American history with Paul Martin and his new book, Villains, Scoundrels, and Rogues, Incredible True Tales of Mischief and Mayhem.
Last night, the Iron County Board deliberated and ultimately voted unanimously to evict the Harvest Camp in the Pinoki Hills. The Kuturay, also known as LCO tribal members, have been occupying the area in an attempt to block a proposed iron ore mine from being established there.
Our Superior-based reporter, Mike Simonson, has been covering this issue, as you've been hearing. He joins us now to get us up to speed on the County Board's decision last night. Mike, thanks so much for being here with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now, this has been in the news kind of on and off for almost the last year. Last night, all of a sudden, yesterday, the county board deliberated about evicting the LCO. They've done this before, so why did last night's meeting finally result in this unanimous decision to evict?
Well, the county board chairman wanted to do this 3 months ago, but their insurance company, the county's insurance company, feared high legal bills. So finally, they examined the situation, gave advice in closed session for about an hour, and said go ahead, because the board unanimously voted to eject. You know, it's kind of funny, the language in the resolution doesn't say evict, it says eject, although I think everybody's assuming it means evict.
And let's talk about what we are discussing here, this so-called harvest camp that is in the middle of the forest by the Pinokis. It's been occupied now for, a year or so?
Since May.
Since May, so we're going on a year. And the point of this was a protest of the proposed Pinoki mine up there?
It's to make that statement, and they originally did ask to have a camp there, and they've erected a couple of wigwams, and there's about half a dozen people there who stay there off and on. But then it developed into a research project where they are looking at the fauna, they're looking at the animals, they're documenting a history of Native Americans in that area. And by doing that, they say it's not a camp, so they're not in violation of the 14-day camping limit.
Now, you reported yesterday that the LCO wasn't notified of this county board meeting ahead of time. So did anybody from the LCO ultimately have an opportunity to participate in the discussion before last night's vote?
The project spokesman, Paul DeMaine, was there. And, they packed the chambers. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a huge chambers. 51 people were there, according to the clerk. But I think the bottom line here is they say that they need to enforce this ordinance or they're going to lose their accreditation to be able to log the timber, and that would cost the county $2 million. And this is a poor county. But this is going to happen in 6 business days, theoretically. But when I talk to the sheriff, you know, this isn't going to be a showdown at the OK Corral or anything to kind of take it off from your last guess. But it's going to be next week. They're going to meet with the sheriff, and the sheriff hopes things can be resolved. But, you know, everybody is saying, or I think most everybody is saying, this is going to be resolved in court, because that's where they have to get the eviction notice from.
And so that was the next question I was going to ask. What recourse now, then, does the LCO have at this point? They're going to have to go to court to try to have that question answered?
Right. They're going to have to do that. But, you know, the 6 business day thing, mm-hmm. they're waist deep in snow there now. And the sheriff said, you know, it could be 6 days. It could be 16 days before everything gets worked out. Or it could be in court with the tribal legal counsel looking at the eviction notice and saying, no, this doesn't apply. We have treaty rights. And the fight begins in court.
And so in terms of the mood, obviously I'm guessing there was a little bit of tension at the county board meeting, but is this sort of re-raising the level of tension in that part of the state right now?
I think they're trying to, at the LCO project camp, keep a, not only civil, they're really making a point to keep it civil, but even sometimes touches of humor. And the county board, I think, feels that they're between a rock and a hard place in this. If they lose that revenue from the timber harvesting, then that will really hurt this county, this small county.
So in the next couple of days, we'll have to be watching and see, A, if anything happens in court, and then what action, if any, the Iron County Sheriff's Department takes.
Yeah, the sheriff's going to meet with them next week. It sounds so dire, eviction, eject, mm-hmm. 6 business days, but they're not going to be dragging people out of there.
All right. Well, Mike, thanks so much for taking the time to get us caught up today.
You betcha, Gene.
That's Mike Simonson. He is Wisconsin Public Radio's news reporter based in Superior, and he's been following this story and keeping us up to date on what is happening in terms of the proposed Pinoki mine and this so-called harvest camp that has been up there. And we'll see how that story develops.
Coming up, we finish our series of interviews on the 3rd anniversary of Act 10, with a focus on how the changes to collective bargaining have affected public employees and their unions. I'm Veronica Bickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.